Here we go. Three questions. Dear Ajahn, how does one develop and cultivate confidence for success in life when one has habitual lack of confidence and low sense of worthiness? Well, actually, that's what I gave a talk on that last night at Nolamara Temple. Number one, please make sure that when anybody praises you, you accept it straight away. Don't think, what do they mean by that? You know, he says, I'm a good meditator. He must be crazy. He says, I'm really kind. You know, what's he trying to get out of me by saying this? No, accept it straight away without any hesitation. When somebody criticizes you, reject it straight away. Oh, they're just having a bad day. It says more about them than it says about me. They don't understand what's going on. Now, if you do that, you may be laughing, but it's completely opposite. There was a psychologist over in Sydney, Eng Kong Tan. He told me that he's a top psychologist, and he was looking at some research papers, and they found that if you have a husband, so if you have a wife, and if you praise her, it takes 17 seconds before she will accept it. You have to keep on praising her again and again. You're a wonderful woman. Your cooking is amazing. You're just such a wonderful partner. You're a great mother to my children. I really like you very much. You're great with the housework. Keep on going. Just 17 seconds hasn't started yet. And only after 17 seconds will she start to actually accept it. Now, that was actually experiments which were done. But you criticize your wife straight away. You know, you're fat. What? They accept it straight away. Why is that? That's the same for guys as well. Why is that? It's because we have been trained not to accept praise. And we've been trained, conditioned, to always listen to criticism. Oh yeah, you're right. I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. I keep on saying the same old jokes every retreat. I'm hopeless. No. When you actually remember all the criticisms, that's where you get low self-esteem. After a while, you start to believe it. Because everyone's telling you just how hopeless you are. And it's amazing, that's most of the population of the world. So in order to cultivate confidence for success, listen to praise. And give each other praise. And filter out all the criticism. So if you can do that, you're actually just getting positive reinforcement throughout your day. And it also means that when you think about yourself, if you criticize yourself, I'll just forget that, that's crazy. You start praising yourself, yeah, that's a good Buddhist. That's a good person. Yes, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And if you do that, it's such a simple thing. We reject praise, we accept criticism, which is why we've got low self-esteem. So try the opposite. Reject criticism. Receive praise. And you find, wow, I'm a good guy. I'm a brilliant girl. I'm a great meditator. Yoo-hoo! And then once you get confidence, of course, once that starts, you live up to those ideas. You live up to the fact that when if you receive praise, it doesn't make you big-headed, it makes you big-hearted. If you receive praise for something, you want to receive that praise again, so you work even harder to repeat that success. And you get more and more successful. So praise yourself and praise others. So if you have a very good meditation, give yourself a reward. Go and have an extra lump of sugar in your cup of tea. Give yourself an extra piece of toast tomorrow morning. Yes, it actually works. I always remember another experiment which somebody told me about. There was this class of kids, only about 4 or 5 years of age, had this very bad eating disorder. So whenever they started eating something, they throw it up straight away. So they're always having to have all these supplements just to keep them alive. And the therapy which worked more than anything else had a whole group of these people with their parents and carers and nurses and who else was there, psychologists. And when any of those kids managed to keep some food down for longer than a minute, they ate, they timed them, and after a minute, yes, the balloons came out, the party came along, and they were all dancing, singing happy songs, whatever it was. And those kids started keeping the food down longer and longer and longer. Because every time they kept it down a bit longer, they were the cause of a party and a celebration. And it's amazing just the result that had. The kids started to eat and keep the food down longer and longer until they're basically cured. So that's the praise, it's just so wonderful. So if anyone here, you know, if you're having a hard time getting up for the morning chanting, if finally on the last day you make it, you come here for the morning chanting, get the balloons out, get the party hats, let's have a celebration. Yes, you made it for the morning chanting, woohoo! And you find it's easy to come next time. So that's why, like, confidence and praise, they're the cause of success. So first of all, you receive praise, and you give it out a lot. You have to give out praise before you can start receiving it. So praise each other. At the end of this retreat, when you're allowed to speak, it's very easy. You go along and say, it's really been nice knowing you, and, you know, sharing the cottage with you, meditating together, it's so wonderful. You can exchange emails and stuff. And it's wonderful, because you feel you're praising each other. And that's a beautiful thing to do, because that starts to give you confidence. And then afterwards, I can do it. Then you get successful. Next one. Are Brahma Viharas and Metta essential to get liberated? Like, Brahma Vihara means the abode, the dwelling place. So Brahma Viharas means a dwelling place of Ajahn Brahm. That's what it means, Brahma Vihara. So it's very essential. I have a place to sleep at night. So it's very... So thank you for giving me a room to stay at night and keeping it nice and clean. But what the Brahma Vihara really means, it's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. Are they essential to get liberated? Yeah, of course it's essential to get liberated. But even if you don't try and deliberately cultivate them, they come anyway. Just think, imagine what happens when you give off all your selfish desires and anger and ill will. All you've got left are the positive emotions. This is one little interesting talk. I remember I gave this talk years ago, and I think Don Wirakodi in the back, one of our past presidents, he said, oh, that was a really good talk, because we always thought that being enlightened means you have no emotions at all. That you are perfectly, you never laugh. You tell a very funny joke, and the arahat just stands there and doesn't even move, doesn't even laugh back. Sometimes I feel you're enlightened when I make all these funny jokes and you don't even laugh. And you don't get upset when somebody calls you a bad name. You're just totally equanimous, just like some robot, some sort of automaton. And that is not what an enlightened being actually is. So what enlightened being is, all the negative emotions, they've disappeared. So there's no anger, no guilt, no fear, no sort of lust or craving or something like that. All those negative emotions have gone, all the selfish emotions are gone. And all that's left is the positive emotions, like kindness, compassion, sympathetic joys. When you get enlightened, everyone else, yeah, wonderful, well done. Isn't it wonderful, another enlightened being in this world? And all those positive emotions, like inspiration when you see a beautiful act being done, all those positive emotions, they still remain. It's the negative ones which we get rid of. So that's why it's not just essential, it's just what happens when you get liberated. Liberated from all the negativity we have, all the fault finding, all the trying to control the world. Instead, we love the world. Dear Ajahn, are monks and nuns required to be aloof? Absolutely. I am the aloofest of monks. Now, of course we're not aloof. How many of you have been hanging around with the monks and nuns either here or somewhere else? How aloof are we? Not really, are we? Sometimes we should be a bit more aloof. Remember, the monks and nuns, the human beings, they are special human beings in the sense that, you know, we have our precepts, you know, which are much more than anything else which people have in this world. So there are these little rules and regulations which we have to keep just for basically common sense. You know that sometimes being an abbot, being a boss of a Buddhist center, sometimes you're always upset somebody. Even the Buddha upsets somebody, and people try to kill him at the end of his life. And so was it 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I ordained bhikkhunis. And so a lot of people were looking to, even actually to try and destroy me and get me into trouble. And sometimes to get a monk into trouble, you try and find them alone with a girl. And then you take photograph and you think, there you go, Ajahn Brahm has got mistress. So, you know, it's so easy to do. So that's why we have these rules. We're never supposed to be alone with a girl in a private place. So that means, you know, you can't get into trouble. But even with the best will in the world, I told this story a couple of days ago, in the best will in the world, sometimes as a monk you get yourself into really compromising situations. I told this because we went over to Safety Bay a few days ago for a house blessing. It's by the ocean, very nice little Thai restaurant. And I remember just going to Bunbury years ago while I was teaching in the prison in the evening. And the only way to get down was the afternoon train, and I had like the afternoon free until, you know, the appointment at the prison so I could teach the prisoners. And so it was a nice afternoon about this time of the year. And so I'm actually a bit couple of weeks earlier than this time of the year, and I went down to Bunbury Beach, you know, a nice quiet place. There was no one there at all. So I just sat down and started meditating for a couple of hours, and when I came out of meditation, I couldn't believe it, there was someone sitting next to me on my left and on my right, and I looked, and on my left was this 17-year-old girl in a bikini, blonde, drop-dead gorgeous, and another brunette on my right-hand side, in bikinis, on the beach. 17-year-old beach babes. And I got quite worried. And all it actually was, is quite innocent, I can tell you now, innocent, it was the end of the year 12 exams, and they just finished that afternoon, the last exam of school, before they go to university. And of course, as soon as they finish school, into their bathers, down by the beach, to celebrate and to relax. And when they went to the beach, they saw this strange guy in a brown robe sitting there. And two of these girls, they were really interested. They really wanted to talk to him about meditation and Buddhism, especially when I was sitting so still there for such a long time. And they were just sitting next to me, waiting for me to come out of meditation, so they could ask questions on meditation and Buddhism. But if anyone had taken a photograph, would you have believed me? I hope you would, because that's what actually happened. So sometimes you've got to be careful not getting into sort of the wrong situation. Otherwise people, you know, there's a few times like that. Another time, and I'm just going to some embarrassing stories now. Just south of here, there's a town called Pinjarra, about 30 kilometers south of here. And so the local Rotary Club invited me to give a talk on Buddhism and meditation. You know, the Rotary Club always have these guest speakers. So I went down there, and it was in a pub, but usually they have the back room of the pub, and there's usually a back entrance. But at this pub, I asked, where's the back entrance? There is no back entrance. The only way to the room is actually to go right through the pub and past the bars. I thought, oh goodness, if somebody sees me walking into the pub, okay, what would you do? And so there was no choice for it, because I said I'm going to go there. So I put my head down, and I could see the room in the back, and I just went, not looking to the left, not looking to the right, hoping that no one would notice me. And I just went past one bar, and somebody grabbed me on the shoulder and pulled me, Ajahn Brahm, what do you want to drink? And again, if you'd have seen me there, it's very hard to sort of, you know, explain what had happened. You know, so I said, no, I'll take an orange juice in the room over there. And I ran as quickly as I could to get in there. But sometimes you have these embarrassing situations. So sometimes, you know, if we're looking a little bit aloof, all it is, we're trying to protect the reputation of monks, especially if you get a senior monk, and sometimes people are looking to try and put you down, or looking for the nuns, trying to find fault with them. There are people like that, always trying to find something wrong. So that's why it's not really being aloof, we're just trying to protect our reputation from the suspicions of the malicious, that's all it is. But you know, hopefully we're just down to earth with you and friendly. So that's important for monks to do that. And that's, of course, that's how I was trained with Ajahn Chah, just such a friendly, kind monk. Dear Ajahn, how to overcome the 11 imperfections, upakilesas. Now that's really the deep meditation. Those defilements, that is when you start to get these beautiful lights come up in the mind. They're called the nimittas. And you know, this is when you get, I haven't gone anywhere near that in this meditation course here, but later on I probably will talk about it. And many of you, this is not the first meditation retreat you've been on, so sometimes you may have had some of these experiences. This is what happens when you're meditating and you're getting quite peaceful and very still, and you start to get some happiness, and you see these beautiful lights come up in the mind. Now, this particular teaching of upakalesas, these are the Buddha's term for the things which disturb the development of that light in the mind. You know, we call it nimitta. And so the major ones, the main two ones, are excitement and fear. And the excitement one is just when, yes, at last, something's happening in my meditation, yeah, here it is. And that excitement is what sort of makes this light disappear straight away. And the other one, which is so close, is being afraid. This is really powerful. Things are really beginning to happen. And you think, maybe not me, maybe other people, but not me. I can't handle this. Because it also comes with a lot of sense of power and energy and bliss. So those are the two ones, which are usually the biggest of the upakalesas. And maybe later on I'll say more about them. But the basic way is just don't do anything. In other words, be totally still. That's how you got there in the first place, to those lights coming up, and don't spoil it. Just sit there and say, oh, the lights come up, they can come if they want, they can go if they want. You know, no excitement, you know, no fear, you've got nothing to lose, no need to, we're not trying to get somewhere in this meditation. So just learn how to be still. And that is usually the way to overcome many of the other upakalesas as well. Not enough energy, too much energy, and all those other of the 11 defilements of that nimitta. And the best explanation of that, of what to do, is Ajahn Chah's simile of the still forest pool. I mean, it's a great answer to the question of how to deal with these upakalesas, because instead of just giving you instructions in words, this gives you like a metaphor, a story, which actually you can imagine when you get to this stage, and it works so beautifully. The still forest pool simile is that in the jungles in Thailand, where we used to go wandering from place to place, you always try and find a river, a lake, or a well, or some body of water in the evening so you could wash. You're walking, you know, through the jungles, and there really were jungles in those days. You're walking through the jungles, you get so sweaty and so dirty. I remember just trying for maybe 2 or 3 days when I was walking, trying for 2 or 3 days without washing, and you felt just so yucky that, you know, just to get some of the stuff off your skin, which felt so such a relief. No, I don't know what I smelt like, but, you know, sort of, it certainly felt terrible. So you can always try and find a body of water. And it's also, you need water to drink and maybe wash a robe or two. And so Ajahn Chah would say he'd find a lake or a river. He would bathe, you know, usually about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Don't leave it too late. And after bathing and filling up his water bottle, he would put his mosquito net just maybe 10, 20 meters away from the water's edge. You don't put it on the water's edge, because in the evening that's when the animals come to also to drink and to wash. And so he would just put his mosquito net 20, 30 meters away from the edge, and he'd watch some evenings as the animals came out to play before Nature Channel or Geographic Channel, whatever it is, National Geographic Channel. That's what the monks would do, to watch the animals play in the wild. And it was obviously great fun. And he would watch these animals play only if he remained still. Because if he moved, the animals would know there was a human being there, and usually the human being would be a hunter trying to kill them. So they had learned to be so sensitive to the presence of a human being, if they smelt or perceived a human, they would run away, even if they were really thirsty. So Ajahn Chah had to be perfectly still for the animals to come out. And he said sometimes he was so still that strange animals would come out, the like of which he'd never seen before. Beautiful animals. But if he even moved an eyebrow or said, wow, they would know there was someone watching and would run away and never come out again for days. But when he was perfectly still, the animals would come out, drink and play, and give him so much delight for hours. That was a simile for the nimitta, the lights in the mind. The animals coming out to play in the still pool that is your mind. They'll only stay there if you're perfectly still, as if they don't know that you're watching. Then they'll come out and stay a long time, and they're so delightful and amazing. So I remember using that when nimittas would come out. You know, I'd think of myself like as an Ajahn Chah in the forest, and just being perfectly still, as if these lights would not know I was watching. I was so still that, you know, they couldn't see me. And then they stay a long time. And that gave me a nice, something very easy to get my head around, to imagine, rather than just a few words. The image was something which was very helpful to stop those upiklesas, those defilements, which stop the nimitta developing. I was just an Ajahn Chah, perfectly still. And then the animals will play and have a wonderful time. It used to be really good fun in the jungles. The other usual story I tell, which is attached to this, was, I remember in the north of Thailand, again in the jungles, quite close to the Burmese border, I spent about 6 months up in the mountains there. It was a very beautiful place. And incredibly natural too. It's a very long way from anywhere. And I remember just, I put a bowl of water out for the birds. And it didn't take the birds a day or two to find a source of water during the dry season. And through a knot hole in the wood of my hut, I'd watch them as they would drink in the evening. And it's a strange thing. I wish I could have had a camera and taken a photo of this. After only about 4 or 5 days, these birds of so many different species had organized themselves. And they were standing in line, waiting, queuing up one after the other. Now that's not normal in Thailand. It's not as well as the Thai people. But these are actually queuing in line, natural birds of different species, waiting for the one in front to finish their bath and their drinking, and then the next one would come in. And, you know, they'd all be in line, one after the other, in a queue, every evening. But then there would always be a queue jumper. Another bird would come and just go straight into the bowl. And you know what would happen? All the birds in the queue, they would get out of queue and jump on that bird, peck him, drive him away. And after they drove him away, they'd all go back in line again. It was the most cutest thing to see. So you see some really strange things in the wild. You know, these weren't trained, this is a long way from any village or town. And so these were natural birds, just learning how to organize themselves, all of different species. It was so cute to see. So that's actually the beauty of actually being out in places where humans don't usually go, to see sort of nature in the raw. And I've never seen that before, seen animals actually queue up. Interesting. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I hope that's the upikalesa answer. That's a big question, and maybe later on I'll say more about it. Dear Ajahn, your teaching on being happy is very lovely, but I do wonder if it is too soft for beginning meditators. I spent many years doing strict and sometimes boot camp practice, and this developed meditation skill for me. If I had easily given way to every sleepiness, etc., I doubt if I could have experienced the meditation states I have done. You also did many years strict training. Please comment. Thanks. Yeah, I know the strict training, and I know the sort of the happy training. And the happy training is the one which has the best results. A lot of times that people actually will not, they go to one retreat and they never go to any more retreats. They're afraid of going to retreats. And the reason is because they just can't stand the pain of not having to sit for such a long time and not being able to move. Not being able to get a good night's sleep because you're in a dormitory on the floor when someone else is snoring. And it's just such a terrible, terrible experience. One of the reasons why that they always take the photographs of the retreats at the end of the retreat when everybody is happy because they're now going home. And that really, yeah, I mean you're very fortunate to have developed something in that very strict, forceful type of meditation. But because, you know, I went through that and I knew too many monks, and nuns too, who never made it, who tried too hard, or were forced to try too hard, and either just physically they just could not take it, or emotionally they got broken, and they went back home. And they never managed to stay and enjoy the beautiful results of meditation. So I just saw that just with my own eyes. And it was only later on when I started reading how the Buddha taught that such strict practices had nothing at all to do with the Buddha's teaching. In fact, it was one of the first things he said not to do. It's called Atta Kilamatanu Yoga, one of the two extremes. And the middle part is supposed to be in between that. The two extremes were things which hurt and tie your body. They're supposed to be avoided. And I like telling people in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, now the story was that he tried all those very tough practices and was not getting anywhere. Fasting, standing on one leg, all that sort of stuff. And then getting nowhere. Now he thought, how can one become enlightened? And he remembered the time under the rose apple tree as a 7-year-old boy when he spontaneously achieved a jhana state. And the insight came up to him, perhaps that's the way to enlightenment, to Bodhi. And the realization came, yes, that is the way to Bodhi. But how to enlightenment? But how can someone with such a tired, emaciated, weak body attain such states? As a result of that, he gave up his asceticism, started eating properly, looking after his body, caring for his body, to such an extent that his 5 disciples left him. They said, he's given up the practice, he's got too soft. He will never become enlightened now. And so he was by himself. And you may all know the story before his actual enlightenment. He had a good meal. I mean a good meal. This was a meal which the Lady Sujata had prepared as an offering to some god. So you don't, you know, make rubbish food for a god. This is the best, highest quality food. And they gave it to the Buddha instead. And the Buddha sat on this root of a tree, made a grass mat for himself. He didn't just sit on the bare. If you ever go and try a root of a tree, especially one of the ficus type trees, they're all knobbly all over the place. You know, they were soon, so they're not level at all. They'll soon just bite into your flesh and cause you all sorts of aches and pains. He made a very thick cushion of grass, first of all. And if any of you have been to Bodh Gaya, it was like a park, in that, on the banks of a river with good air and nice shade. It was a pleasant place to stay in. It wasn't just, you know, in the middle of the jungle with lots of mosquitoes. And it was a very, very pleasant place to be. So this is actually where he got enlightened. And I always remember that, because if you want to get enlightened, you must really avoid all those painful practices. Yeah, you may get some endurance, but you're missing out on the deep meditations, mostly because the best way to let go of the body, for the body to disappear, is when it's relaxed and at ease, and then it can actually disappear very easily. Okay, you can, out of desperation, the body's really aching, in great pain, very sick, you can let go of the body then as well, but that's a tougher thing to do. Most people find it much more, people can let go of their body and access the mind in deep meditation, and the body is comfortable. So that's actually why I've been teaching like this for many years and had far better results. So the happy meditations are the best. And actually the happiness in the mind, that is crucial. All the time you saw that taught by the Buddha. Avoid the pleasures of the 5 senses and the pain of asceticism. But in between those two is the pleasure of the 6th sense. And that's made very, very clear in the Irana Vibhanga Sutta, one of my favorite suttas, where the Buddha explains what this middle path is. and said it is the pleasure of the sixth sense, the inspiration, the joy of compassion, the happiness you get from doing dana. That's a mental pleasure. He didn't say to avoid those things, to cultivate those things, and to cultivate the happiness in the mind in deep meditation. And it's so much so that the Buddha said such things as sukhino chittang samadhiyati. From happiness, the mind becomes still. Happiness is a cause for stillness. And if you haven't got that happiness, the mind will not become still. That's directly from the word of the Buddha. Not in one place, many, many places. So because of that, because you know, when I started, I just did this by trial and error first of all, then I started reading the suttas, and my goodness, this is the way. Get the happiness up, then you get still, then you really get blissed out, you get enlightened. So it's not just lovely teaching, it's actually the most effective, and it is the way the Buddha taught. What are the ways to attain contentment and being happy here and now? Can it be done through willpower? Very often it's difficult to convince myself to be content. Contentment be attained before enlightenment? Be really attained before enlightenment? A very good question. I mean, what is contentment? Is the absence of craving, the absence of wanting anything. This wonderful wisdom that this is good enough. It's a wonderful thing that suffering, what is suffering, but suffering is caused by craving. Suffering is what happens when you want something more. So when you want something else, you're suffering. So it's so easy to understand the cause of suffering is wanting, and the end of suffering is letting go of wanting. Basically, second and third noble truths. Which is one of the reasons why, I haven't said this yet, it usually comes up in the first talk, there are two types of meditation. The first type of meditation, that is not samatha vipassana, that's not what I mean. The two types of meditation are second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. Second noble truth, for those of you who are Buddhists, is the cause of suffering is wanting, craving. So that is called second noble truth meditation. I want jhana, I want enlightenment, I want at least be peaceful. That wanting is the very cause of you getting upset, depressed, frustrated, are you suffering in meditation. So if your meditation is not happy, if your meditation is suffering, great or small, you have just been doing second noble truth meditation. You've been wanting something. Third noble truth meditation, or the third noble truth, the end of suffering comes when you end wanting. Or end of suffering is called nibbana, the highest happiness. So third noble truth is when you're meditating, you get very happy. Congratulations, you've just been doing third noble truth meditation. You've been ending suffering. If you have a look what you've been doing, you'd be practicing contentment, not wanting anything. And I like telling people, everyone sitting here has always had these moments in their life, probably many moments, of great happiness. And I like to ask people, now can you recall the moment in your life so far you've had the greatest happiness? A time when you don't want to be anywhere else, don't want to be with any other people or any other place. Just so happy. That is called contentment. It doesn't have to be the most perfect or most beautiful place in the world. It doesn't have to be with the most amazing, wonderful people. But you had that one feeling or many feelings of total contentment. You had a choice, no, this is the people I want to be with, this is the time, this is the place, I'm happy. That's called a taste of freedom, a taste of enlightenment. Totally content to be here. It doesn't have to be perfect. Those moments is where you get to understand what this meditation is all about. When you let go of all wanting and craving, you're totally content, this is good enough. Then the mind becomes free. And that lack of wanting, that contentment, it's not a stable thing. It deepens with every second. Contentment is like a bushfire which starts with one little flame and soon is a conflagration. Once you start being content, you go deeper and deeper and deeper into peace, into stillness, into joy. Closer and closer to Nibbana. Just because you are just happy to be here. This is good enough. No wanting, no craving, nothing to attain, of just being here. And it's not boring at all, it really starts to take off. That's actually what happens. So the way to attain contentment of being happy here, what do you want anyway? Where do you want to be? Will there be anywhere better than where you are now? And all you people trying to get enlightened or someone, have you got any idea what someone is? This is one of the weird things about Buddhists. They all want to be enlightened, but they haven't got a clue what enlightenment is. We're not quite sure what it is, but we want to get it. And that's really crazy. It's like getting on a bus, you know, with Nibbana on the front, not knowing where the hell it's going to. It's really crazy. Do you really want to get there when you arrive? So first of all, find out, have a little idea what enlightenment is before you get on the bus to become a Buddhist. But you may not know what enlightenment is, but you know what contentment is. And it gives you a feeling that this is a path, the end of craving, beautiful happiness, and at last you don't have any business to do. You don't have to go and attain anything, or change yourself, or get somewhere. Life is just so busy. There's always something wrong and you've got to fix it up. There's always another place to get to, there's another day of work to do. But in meditation, it's no work anymore. I'm not trying to fix up anything. Enough of all this fixing up. This is good enough. I'm just sticking with what I've got. That's enough. I'm going to rest now and just be here. That's the path of contentment. And you don't have to have everything perfect before you be content. That's the biggest problem with people. They want to make it, fix it all up first of all. Once all the dishes are washed, once all the bills are paid, once all my debts are paid off, you know, once my kids have left home, once I get retired, then I'll be happy. That never comes. So, what the hell? I don't care, even though my kids are in a big mess, even though my husband is deserting me, even though I just owe so much of money, even though I've got cancer and I'm dying next week, what the hell? I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to enjoy this moment. I'm not going to try and make it perfect. I'm just going to be at peace now. This is good enough. That's how you get enlightened. Anyway, as a lay person living in the lay world, if one feels stuck, limited, declining towards poverty, how should one deal with it? Easy. Become a monk or become a nun. You're inclining towards poverty, so you're inclining towards a monastic life. We are poor. If you feel stuck and limited, exactly, that's what you become a monk for. So you can be free like the birds, not stuck anymore, totally free. So that's what you should do, easy. So come and see me afterwards, we'll shave your hair and ordain you tonight. Everyone declines towards poverty. You can't take anything with you. You'll die as poor as you came into this world. All this money we have is only a temporary thing. So, you know, you're just getting old. It's wonderful to have less things to worry about, like money. This year I have really taken on the precept of not lying into my life. It has made me aware that being honest in daily life is sometimes not valued by everyone. Even when answering the question, how are you, I find myself not completely honest. I sometimes also feel hurting others, people's feelings, through my honesty, even when it's not my intention. What does the Buddha say about this precept? Are there situations in which lying is okay? How can I practice this precept with wisdom? Thank you so much. Look, you don't need to tell people they're a stupid idiot, you know, to be honest. You know, you can actually use, like, skillful speech. You know, to say, you know, you're not enlightened yet. Same thing as being a stupid idiot. So, sometimes it's a skillful use of speech. Obviously, you don't need to lie to people, but skillful use of speech is amazing. Someone told me this story once of this fellow he was in Holland in the Second World War, and he was harboring some Jewish a family in his house. And when the German Gestapo came to investigate, knocked on his door, they had some rumor that he was looking after some of these Jewish people, and if he got found out, he would be shot as a traitor, and the Jewish family would be sent to one of the concentration camps where they'd be gassed and killed. And so they asked him, "Are there any Jewish people in your house?" And he also had made a vow never to lie. If he told the truth, he'd be shot, and so would these people. "Maybe you can sacrifice your own life for your honesty, but sacrifice other people, is that fair?" But then he couldn't lie. So you know what he said? And this is a true story. He said, "Please come inside and look for yourself." And he said it with such honesty, they said, "Okay, thank you, sir," and went on to the next house. They didn't even look. And that's actually the power of honesty. You know, they think this guy, you know, he's got nothing to hide. He said, "Come in and have a look." So sometimes skillful speech, you don't have to lie. You can use skillful speech, wise speech, kind speech. And that's a great trick, but a wonderful trick, you know, of wisdom and compassion which you can learn. And you don't have to lie to do the right thing. So well done. But sometimes it's not valued by everyone, but most people do value it. It's wonderful to have a person who's honest. And the other thing about honesty, which I've been really pushing a long time, why is it that people lie? And the reason is because you get more benefit of lying than you do for telling the truth, most people. The old joke is this person, he was being, actually it's my new book, he was being tried in a court of law on a charge of murder, and when he was being questioned by the prosecution, you know, it was quite obvious he wasn't telling the truth, and so the judge interrupted the prosecution's interrogation of him and said, "Sir, do you realize what the penalties for perjury are?" And perjury is like lying in a court of law. And the prisoner said, "Yes, I know what the penalties of perjury are, and they're far less than the penalty for murder." which is why you lie. And that's why people lie to each other, because the penalties for lying are far less than for telling the truth in most places. And so I've encouraged, especially parents of kids, please tell your children, as long as you tell the truth, you will not be punished. If you lie, you will be. It doesn't matter what you've done. You've been taking drugs, you know, you're pregnant, you know, or your wife has had an affair with somebody else. She won't tell you because she's afraid that the penalty for telling the truth will be worse than the penalty for lying. So the only way we can develop more truth in this world is to have more amnesty, more forgiveness. As long as you tell the truth, you'll be forgiven. And that's what happened in South Africa. In South Africa, Desmond Tutu's Truth of Reconciliation Commission, as long as people told the truth, they'll be forgiven. That is what allowed the truth to come out. Now there's many Sri Lankans here, and you know recently the Chogyam meeting, the people trying, let's have an investigation into what happened at the end of the war between the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan government. If there's going to be a commission where there's penalties, then that's a waste of time. But if the stupid Western world would say, okay, yeah, let's have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, no penalties, amnesty, we're not trying to sort of punish or get revenge, then the truth can come out. Punishment is what drives the truth underground. Or in Thailand, where the red shirts and the yellow shirts are at each other again. So you know what happened in the Thaksin regime? You know, in the past governments, the only way you can find out is to have an amnesty. And then people will tell the truth. But if there's going to be some punishments or some fines, they're going to lie. So I always like to see what the cause of lying is in the world. And it's always punishments. So forgiveness is what brings the truth up to the surface. Anyway, According to Buddha's teaching, everything including effort arises conditionally, but Buddha also said on his last teaching, strive on untiringly. He never said strive on untiringly, he said apamadena sampadesa. Apamadena is like the opposite of being mindful, it's being heedless. And sampadeta means just develop that heedlessness. Develop that heedfulness. And that heedfulness is not an effort, it's more like a mindfulness, an awareness. I gave a story to the monks recently about the simile of the snake. And that simile of the snake is, in your meditation, now you'll have your biggest problem in meditation. The one which always tends to get you, thinking too much, worrying too much, getting excited when you get deep. And that's like a snake on the path waiting for you. If you program yourself to look out for that snake, then you see it before it can bite you. You're on the lookout for it. If you know that's the biggest problem in your meditation, say sleepiness, when you start meditating, I'm going to be really on the lookout for sleepiness, you'll be able to avoid it. You're heedful of the problem. And that's what the Buddha meant in his last words of advice. Be heedful. Develop that looking out for the problems in your life. Maybe you've got a relationship, a marriage, and you always get into this bad speech together. You know, always putting people down. That's a snake for your relationship. Look out for that. And if you remind yourself, look, I'm not going to say these rotten words to my wife. It's not right for me to sort of say this terrible stuff. That's your snake, and you're heedful. And as long as you're heedful of these things, you can avoid it before it gets like a snake crawled all around you or bites you. If you see it, it's just next to you, it's too late. They're going to bite you. If you see it when it's way over there, it's so easy to avoid. So the heedfulness is catching these problems in life earlier because you are heedful of them. So that's actually what the Buddha really meant. It's not strive on untiring. That's a really bad translation. If you strive on, you're going to get tired. You can't have striving untiringly. If the effort we put forth is conditioned, what's the meaning of the Buddha's last teaching? Why did the Buddha say that? I think I mentioned that. When I put effort on learning Dhamma and doing meditation, it's all conditioned by some earlier causes. Yeah, it is, and they're stupid causes. You never get anywhere that way. All that effort, where are you trying to get to? Effort is always trying to get somewhere else. And that's one of the reasons why it goes in the wrong direction. Instead, let go. Stop moving. There's one thing I haven't said yet, which is important. I have to say this every meditation. The meditation is called stillness, not concentration. Please get that word out of your heads. It's not about concentrating. Concentration is what you get through effort. You also get a headache too. Stillness is the real meaning for samadhi. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is right stillness, not right concentration. That translation has caused a lot of mischief and stopped a lot of people understanding what meditation is and getting enlightened. Stillness. So when you talk about stillness, you understand all effort stops you being still. And here we go. The demonstration I give at every retreat. I am now, you can have to help me here, buddy. I'm now, you can know where you are. I'm now going to hold this water perfectly still. Has it stopped moving yet? Okay. So I'm now going to put forth effort. I really am. I'm trying. Has it stopped moving yet? That's why effort will never get stillness. How do I get this water to be perfectly still? So if you put it down, let it go. Stop holding it, stop trying. And you sit here doing absolutely nothing. That's important, doing nothing. Is it still? It's pretty good, it's got a little bit of shaking. Because that's because of the aircon. But I could never hold it that still. Now that's how we meditate. If you hold the mind, force it, it always moves. If you let it go, let it be. Put it down. Stop doing things. then stillness comes all by itself. It's not willpower, it's wisdom power. And the other thing which I always notice, have ever you noticed that people who strive so much are the control freaks? The ones with big ego and big anger. That's what happens if you put forth effort in the traditional sense. And I've seen many people on these retreats, they sit much longer than I do. And they really put forth a lot of effort. And after the retreat's finished, even beforehand, they get angry at everybody. Stop making so much noise in my cottage. Stop slurping your food. It's control freaks. If they can't control themselves, they try and control you. And that is not the way of Buddhism. But if you let go, not striving, somebody bangs the door in your cottage. Fine, it's only a little sound. Bang, and it's gone. If you get angry, it's banging in your head for minutes afterwards. So you can see the difference between letting go and striving. It's the nature of people. People make noises. It's impossible not to make a noise. So you can expect the people in your cottage will make noises, just like you do as well. So accept it. Let it be. You can't control it. And then there's no problem anymore. You don't get angry. When you don't get angry, you're kind, you're peaceful. That's the way we meditate. You put things down. Okay. And what's the difference between being conditioned and being determined when we say everything is conditioned? Okay, the other part of this question here is why do people put forth effort? It is because you've been brainwashed to put forth effort. When you were in school, in your life, everything you've ever achieved in life is through effort. And now you think that's the way you're going to get enlightened. And you need to be reconditioned, otherwise known as brainwashing. And this is what I'm here for, to brainwash you. I am reconditioning you to stop, let go, desist, just be. And after a while, those are such strange words. And you've done all the striving before, it's got you nowhere, it's just got you a headache, got you all confused. Every now and again, out of sometimes desperation, say, okay, I'm going to give it a try. Instead of like striving hard to me, I'm just going to sit here, see what happens, doing absolutely nothing. And you find it's just so peaceful and so wonderful. You start to understand what meditation is and why the Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree rather than just chop the Bodhi tree down or climbed up it or whatever. He just sat still underneath it. That is the way to get enlightened. So I'm reconditioning you to stop and to let go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I better be quick. Mind arises and passes away. After it disappears, nothing is left. And the mind which arises later is conditioned by the earlier mind. How can the earlier mind have effects on the new arising mind if it has been extinct completely? For example, how can we remember the past accurately, though not all the time, but still pretty often, if the past mind has been extinct completely? Ah, this is the transference of information. How come the information, you know, from one mind moment can go on to the next mind moment, or even more interestingly, from your past life to this life? It's quite clear that past lives exist. There's just too many people who can remember their past lives. Document it. And for those of you who don't know, that very recently one of our members, he'd learned how to be a hypnotist. And just for fun, he's been regressing people. And as one of our other members, he regressed this guy. He's a people you would know, Ananda, in Nolamara every weekend, and Don, you know these people. And this person who's regressed, he got very clear regression into a previous life where he was a British soldier who was sent to Perth 150 years ago. And after he finished his commission as an officer in the British Army, he worked for 1 year in Fremantle Jail. This was 150 years ago. And then applied for a grant of land north of Albany where he built his first house himself out of stone. Got married, lived to I think 78 years of age. He knew all of the names, even the place where he was buried. And, of course, when you have such clear recall with names and everything, so the hypnotist, who remained anonymous, but he's been a president of our Buddhist society many times, and he's got white hair, and he's also our marriage celebrant. You know who he is. And, of course, they checked it all out, and it's all 100% accurate. And recently, he hasn't been to his grave yet, but, you know, he knows where it is. But his house was heritage listed because it was one of the first stone houses in that part of Australia. And so they went down with the past president of our Buddhist society to try and check it out. And he knew exactly where it was. When he got there, it wasn't there. He said, what's going on here? It was here. And then the farmer checked up with the farmer. It's heritage listed. And the farmer eventually agreed. He actually confessed, yeah, I destroyed it. Even though it's against the law to do that. He said, it was in the paddock. Why are these natural heritage people tell me I should be here? But they got the plans, and it actually is exactly where he said it was, even though it's not there now. And it's exactly as he described it. It's 100% perfect recall of all the names and stuff of his wife, his kids, and everything else. And he's just one of our members. And just interesting, though, he said, just how this past actually carries on to the present. You know what his job was before he became, before he joined our Buddhist society? He was in the Australian Navy. I thought it was an army at first, but it was actually the Navy. It must have been the Navy before, because they only sent Navy people over to Australia. So he was in the Navy before, and this year he just joined up in the Navy. That's, you know, what he remembered. And also that when he joined our Buddhist society, he volunteered to do what? Prison visiting. And he told me, he said, look, I'm just reliving my past life. It's all coming back again. His tendencies in the past were being repeated in this life. And when it's somebody you know, just every Friday night you see him down there. So, you know, sometimes, you know, this is real stuff. So how on earth can those memories actually be accessed, you know, in this life? You died in Western Australia and now he's been reborn. But there's no family, there's no genetic link. He's not in the same family. But how can that actually, can you get those memories? And the only way I can do it, you know, using my physics, is something we call action at a distance or even resonance. You know, sometimes you don't need a postman between the moon and the oceans of this world to actually to move those oceans. We all know the moon affects the tides. But no one has ever found what is the thing which sends the information from sort of a body to the waves. Gravity. Never found a particle. Never found a wave. No one knows how gravity works. But it does work. Something moves a long many thousands of miles away, and something here feels the effects, but no one knows why. That's why we used to call it action at a distance. That's in space, why not in time? Your past life resonating with this life right now. So you can access the information. That's how mind works as well. Interesting, but it's true. I'm going to keep going on. Can you please explain what you experience in the different levels, depths of meditation? Yes, I can. That's the answer. I'll give you more detail later on, just the bliss of happiness, because I'll describe meditation later on. So I'm not being flippant. I will actually describe that later on. Okay. In city life, sexual desires are easily aroused, especially through public media. How to deal with, alleviate such desires when it gets aroused? As we were talking today, just at the tea time before we came up here, of actually with the sheep, because we're talking about sheep. Actually, they put a rubber band around the sheep's private, the male ones, private parts, until it falls off. So I'll take any monks who have any problems with sexual desire over here. Rubber bands are very cheap. Snip, snip, snip. So that's what. Okay, that won't really work. If such desires are easily aroused, precious of me, to how to deal with an even such desires when it gets aroused? Now, one of the things with sexual desire, with any type of desire, you only have a partial perception of what's happening. In other words, you see the most beautiful and attractive part of that sexual desire. Now, what you should do is the Buddha, this is actually from the Buddha's teaching, you see the gratification, you see the joy of having a relationship or having sex or, you know, buying the beautiful dress or the new gizmo from the IT shop. You see the attraction, now see the danger. See the downside. Now, people don't like to do that because they like getting sort of attracted and they like fantasizing. That girl, she's so beautiful, I like her very much, she must like me too. I'll be a wonderful thing for her and I can give her such happiness in life. I'm sure she'll really enjoy having me as her partner. And you get fantasized like this because you always want to see the nice part of it. But instead, deliberately start to think of the downside of sexual relationships. Babies, 20 years of suffering having to bring this kid up, getting up in the middle of the night, you know, when they're really young, always crying, you don't know what the heck they want, and eventually when your wife divorces you, you have to pay maintenance, you know, all this money to your wife for this kid you can never see, because there's so much problems, and when the kid does get to 14 or 15, they really start giving you big trouble then. Your daughters get pregnant and you've got to fix that up, and your sons go off to Dunsborough and they get drunk and the police call you up and you've got to go and sort it all out and just, oh God. So you see the downside. You're not just saying only the downside. You see the good side and the downside. You see both sides of the equation. When you see both sides of the equation, it's much easier to let go. If that's what you want to do. And if you do want to go for it, at least you know what you're getting into with the relationship. You're not going in there blind. They always say that love is blind and marriage is an institution for the blind. That's what they say, love is blind, marriage is an institution. And it is, because we go in there thinking we're going to be happy ever after. Very few people get married actually knowing what they're doing. It's going to be a lot of hard work. And it's not an easy thing to do. And if people actually go in there with wisdom, fair enough, they make their choice. But then in the world outside, please just don't just see the nice, it's just like the advertisements on TV. You always see the beautiful side, you know, of the wonderful meal you can have. You never see the shit which comes out the other end later on in the day. You always see the beautiful side of things. You see the wonderful car, the great house. You never see the mortgage which you have to pay off for years afterwards. So in order to balance it, you see the gratification, that's what the media and the shops and the adverts tell you. You have to put forth some effort, some deliberately trying to see the downside of these things. When you see the downside of these things, you can make an informed choice then. A lot of times, it's not worth it. It's not worth having the affair with somebody else's husband or somebody else's wife. Yeah, it's fine, you can see the gratification, the excitement in it. Especially for guys, you're always seeing, yeah, you won't get caught, you can get away with it, but you can actually just, you know, cheat on your wife without ever getting found out. But that was totally disproved, I think, 2 years ago, when the head of the CIA, General Petraeus, you think if anybody could hide the truth, the head of the CIA could do it, and he got caught by his wife. If he can get caught, there's no hope for any of you guys. You haven't been as hardly trained to keep a secret. And he got found out, so just give up, you're going to get caught. So when you know you're going to get caught, it's not worth it. So you may have sexual desire, easily aroused, through public media, but you're going to get caught. Is it really worth it? So when you see the danger, as well as the gratification, then you've got to make a good choice. A lot of times, it's not worth it. Thank you to everybody. Body gets quite hot during meditation. Why? Because you've got too many blankets on. Look at you all. This is summertime in Australia. I don't know why. I can't really believe this. You know, this is really hot weather. And look at how many blankets you've got. Right on. Take your blankets off and then ask the question. Thank you so much for your kindness, compassion, generous teachings. Thank you. My questions. What is body contemplation? being aware of your body and relaxing it, letting it be. It's not body contemplation, it's body awareness. Kaya gatasati. Contemplation means like thinking. And you already do enough thinking. So stop thinking about the body, but feel the body. Experience it. And when you don't sort of look at the body with negativity, you just experience the body, it soon relaxes by itself and then disappears. How can we overcome attachment to our greed, sensual pleasures? We are constantly exposed by the media advertising that feel good, that feed greed, and it seems difficult not to be affected. You know, it's amazing just the synchronicity that so often on these retreats, two questions right next to each other with almost the same question. And I think I just answered that. That's how your greed, sensual desire are overcome. You see the negative side of it, not just the positive side of it. And when you have all the information, you can make usually a good decision. It's just not worth it. There are some stories in the suttas. I maybe have to leave some of these till later on because I'm not going to finish them all. There are some stories in the suttas of enlightenment experiences where it seems unlikely the individuals concerned were practicing the jhanas or even samadhi. The nun who didn't have a moment's peace and tried to hang herself. Or Bahia, the guy who was run over by a cow. Does this mean it's possible to become enlightened without jhana, or did they have jhana in a past life? Do they get jhana in the last moment before death? And certainly with Bahia, I remember writing an article about that. That wasn't just this ordinary guy, because he was one, I think, of 6 monks who, in the previous time of the previous Buddha, Kassapa, this is many Buddhas, not just one, decided to climb up a mountain, throw down the ladder, and literally it was enlightenment or die. I think one became enlightenment, another one became an anagami, and Bahia didn't get anything. When he was reborn in the west of India, he became a sailor and lost a few fortunes in his short life. And once he got shipwrecked off the coast, and when he managed to swim ashore, he had no clothes on at all. And so the only thing he could do was to get some bark just to cover himself up. And so he's wandering around sort of the shore just after escaping from being shipwrecked, wearing just simple bark, and all the people in the village thought he was a holy man. And they started giving him things, because that's what they do if you're a holy man in India, they start giving you things. And when they started giving him things and treating him with respect, he thought this is much better than working for a living. And so he just became a holy man, just for the material pleasures of it. And there he was, because he was wearing bark. You know, if you ever go to India, it's amazing. You do anything weird and the people think you're holy. And so he was wearing bark. They thought he was a holy man, and he was really getting into it. And he thought, wow, there's so many people who respect me. I must be enlightened. And that's when his old mate from the previous life, who was an anagami, said, no, you're not enlightened. You're nowhere near enlightened. You're just wearing this simple clothes, and it just impresses people, but they haven't got a clue. And he said, but there is an enlightened person called the Buddha, and he lives, the other side of India. Go and see him. And according to the story, just in one night, he traveled all the way across India. And he said he did have psychic powers from the previous life. Yeah, he may not have got enlightened in the previous life, but he almost must have had those jhanas. And when he actually went to see the Buddha, he had those psychic powers just to go all across India in one night. Then the Buddha just gave him a simple teaching. He understood it straight away. So he did have past form. That was the story of Bahia. So he did have a lot of good karma. The nun who tried to hang herself, I'm not going to tell that story because otherwise you might try and get a rope and hang yourself, because that's one of the ways to become enlightened. Not recommended. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for being whatever. Question, is it helpful to read an inspiring book like in the words of the Buddha while on retreat, or is it best just trying to be always in this moment? No, an inspiring book is fine to read during a retreat as long as you don't spend all the time reading books. Ajahn Chah used to give a lovely simile. Reading is like the sweets at the end of a meal. So, even here you have your lunch, but there's always a cake or something at the end of the meal which you can enjoy, but don't just eat the cake or the ice cream. If you do, you get very sick. So don't just do the study, read. Otherwise, you're just unbalanced. Take the main course first of all. The main course is the meditation. And then you can have the books as a sweet course at the very end. So books are okay, but don't do too much books. The Ajahn, is that the less willpower to be used in meditation, the better? Will there be any situation willpower is needed in meditation? No, not in meditation. Only maybe I should actually stop that and say, the willpower to say no, to stop, to restrain, to let go. It's literally the will to stop will. That is the only willpower we use in meditation. Restraint. Letting go. Which takes willpower to turn off this control freak thing. Stop. Leave it alone. That is the willpower we use in meditation. The willpower to stop. And I think I was to the monks. I've been following this research of this psychologist called Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T. And he did these amazing experiments, first of all, to show that what we think as willpower is not the originator of action. Action is already started, and then we're aware of this thing we interpret quite incorrectly as what starts the action, and then the action happens afterwards. By the time you're aware, by the time you think you're willing, it's already happening. This is the experiment, was just flexing your hand open, and with the other hand you pressed a button when you thought that you were going to open your hand. At the same time, they had this gizmo on the brain which measured your readiness potential. They can see when in the brain you were originating that action. And they found out very clearly that it starts in the brain first of all. The brain decides that you're going to move the hand. And then you're aware of this thing which you interpret as you are now deciding you're going to move your hand. The choice happens afterwards, not before. So what you interpret as your choice is not what starts an action. And then you actually move. What he also found is that what you can do is actually stop. You have a little fraction of a second where you can restrain and say, no, I'm not going to do this. It seems that that is the only power you have, to restrain, to stop and say no. Everything else is conditioned. Really great research. Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T, looking him up on the web. I have doubt about when I have time, which one should come first. Develop a spiritual path first of all and help others, or should I balance a spiritual path and volunteering together? Together is the only way. If you think you're going to develop the spiritual path just by yourself, alone, it does not work. You'll be dry, you will have no energy, because every time you volunteer, you serve, you help other people, you have an act of compassion or generosity, that gives you this spiritual energy, the oomph, which means when you meditate, you can start with inspiration. And that inspiration will lead you to the happiness which leads to deep meditation, which leads to seeing things as they truly are, which leads to enlightenment. And my own journey as a monk, for the first few years in Thailand, I was always helping other monks. And some of these other monks, they were off in the jungles meditating by themselves, and I thought, wow, these guys must have really great meditation. I'm doing their visas and helping others. And these monks having all this time in the caves and the jungles, not doing a thing for other people. And then when we came back and met each other, my meditation was far, far better than theirs. I just couldn't understand, what have you guys been doing all that time? Now I realized that little bit of help which I was giving other people was giving me this great power, which meant that when I did meditate, I was way ahead. So you balance the service and the solitude. If either of those are out of balance, you don't get very far on the spiritual path. If you just have your solitude, one retreat, 6 months, 12 months, not helping other people, you find that you're dry You can get peaceful, but you can't get the joy and the happiness and the bliss which takes you into jhanas and beyond. But if all you ever do is serve other people, you don't have any time for stillness at all. You just get too restless. So the spiritual path is the balance between service and solitude. And you find your balance. So right here, on this retreat, if somebody is sick, please be the one who volunteers to take their lunch to them. You'll have a great meditation afterwards. Somebody just leaves their cup and they haven't washed it, you wash it for them. You get very, very deep meditation as a result. If you think, no, I've got to go back and start my meditation, I can't spend time wasted washing other people's dishes for them. That attitude, you never get anywhere in meditation. I'll make this the last question because it's getting a bit late. The questions which I haven't answered, I'll do it tomorrow. Ajahn, lots of metta. What is the difference between thinking and contemplating during meditation? How to do contemplation? Is it necessary? No, thinking is contemplation. Contemplating is thinking. So don't just think about something, just know it. And the usual simile, which, you know, is Lao Tzu going for a walk. It's a great simile, that's why I keep repeating it. Going for a walk with his disciple one evening, and they had a golden rule, you must not speak when you're on a walk with the master. And when they came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset, and it was such a beautiful sight, the disciple forgot the rule and blurted out, look at that beautiful sunset. He'd broken the rule, had spoken. And the master turned around and went back to monastery. And when he got back, the master said, that guy can never go on a walk with me ever again. And the guy's friends, that's a bit too harsh, you know, never go on a walk with you. Maybe ground him for a year or a month, but not forever. And anyway, why is it such a bad thing to say, what a beautiful sunset? And that is when this great master said this very, very powerful teaching for me anyway. Lao Tzu said, when that young man said, what a beautiful sunset, he wasn't looking at the sunset anymore. He was only looking at the words. Every time you're thinking about something, you're not seeing it. You're seeing the description, not the thing itself. Basket. If you say basket, think basket, you're not seeing the basket, you're just seeing the description. So, see if you can see things and experience things without giving it a name. Then you can actually see it. Unfortunately, we've been taught ever since we were small to give things names. You know, you see, mummy, daddy, house, teacher, dog. And we've been giving things a names for such a long time, we forgot what they represent. All we know now is the names, not the things. So when you actually contemplate or you think, you're missing out on reality. Do you really have to give it a name to see what a beautiful sunset it is? Just see the sunset. And stop giving things names. Stop contemplating it. When you stop giving things names, then you may be able to see them. Easy. So there we are. That's enough for tonight. It's 9:30, and you need your beauty sleep. Especially some of you are getting old. You need it more than the young people. So please have a nice night tonight. And the other questions I haven't answered, I promise I will answer them tomorrow. But in the meantime, those of you who've got energy, you can meditate some more. If you want to go back and meditate in your room, that's a nice place to meditate. I've already seen some people meditating on the stupas outside. Great place to meditate. So just use this facility wherever you want to meditate, please meditate there. And those of you, please, no need to set your alarm clocks tomorrow morning. Whatever time you get up then. If you get up for the chanting, fine. If you get up for breakfast, fine. Whatever time you get up, keep it natural. Don't force it. Don't think how much you should sleep. Feel how much you should sleep. And that way you become much healthier, more happy, more content. Okay. Sadhu. Sadhu. Very good. Good night. See you in the morning, maybe. Who knows?